from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Americans went to the polls this week and rendered what seems to be their verdict on the first 2 years of the Trump administration. The result, a divided government and the start of a 2020 presidential campaign. We talk with Register contributor Paul Kengor, and then we turn to the U.S. Bishops' meeting, which will be in Baltimore this coming week. Will they make any progress in addressing the clergy sex abuse scandal? We will find out from Joan Frawley Desmond, our senior editor, for a little preview of what the annual Bishops' meeting will hold. I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio. And of course, I'm joined by Matthew Bunsen, the Register's senior editor and my co-host. Matthew, welcome.
Always good to be with you. A lot of news, as always.
Of course. And you're in the seat of it all there in Washington. And of course, the Bishops' meeting will be really close by in Baltimore this week. And of course, there's a lot to talk about with that, but we'll do that in the next segment. First, we're joined by the Register contributor, Paul Kengor, who has often given us comments for stories on political topics, but has also written for us extensively. So welcome, Paul.
Yeah, thanks, Jeanette. Matthew, good to be with you again.
And of course, we're recapping the elections of this week, and as you kind of forecasted in some of the articles that you commented on, that this was really there were a lot of bellwether races. This is really a commentary on how President Trump is doing, and so let's talk about what the takeaways are and how it all fared.
Well, it looks like the predicted big victory for the Democrats in the House, and looks like probably about a 25 seat or so advantage, you know, probably around 225 to 200. I mean, so many of these races still, right, are you know, going to be days after the election till all of them are fully called. But so in that case, you're going to have a House that will. I mean, we've been concerned, right, about civility and rancor and division in politics. Well, it's about to get really, it's about to ratchet up even more because they are dedicated to taking down Donald Trump, to trying to impeach him if they can. And you know, Van Jones, who's the you know, very liberal commentator, very left-wing commentator, CNN, and he described it as not a blue wave, but a blue war, as he called it, a blue war. And he called it an infestation of hate and division. So the House is going to get really ugly, really nasty. On the Senate side, though, this is a major victory for Republicans. They're probably going to pick up at least four major seats. The Claire McCaskill one in Missouri, Joe Donnelly in Indiana, Heitkamp, North Dakota, looks like Rick Scott in Florida. So it's probably going to be 53, 54 seats for the Republicans in the Senate. And even people like Mitt Romney, which I think that probably surprised a lot of people on election night. I probably thought, Mitt Romney's running? So Mitt Romney is now in the Senate. And so you know, that will be really good for pro-lifers when it comes to judicial appointments. And I don't think that you're going to see another Supreme Court vacancy in the next 2 years.
Right.
I know people say, well, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she's in her mid-80s. Stephen Breyer, I think, is around 80. They're going to hang on.
Right.
I don't think they're going anywhere. But people don't realize there are a lot of other judicial appointments all around the country that aside from the Supreme Court. And so the Republicans should have a very easy and comfortable margin getting those through. And you know, Jeanette, I think part of this is the Kavanaugh backlash. There's a piece by David Catron in the American Spectator calling this the Kavanaugh revenge. I think the Kavanaugh thing really blew up in the faces of liberal Democrats.
And that's
motivated. Yeah.
That's really interesting because, and I was going to ask you about that because, so, you know, there were so many predictions that whole Kavanaugh mess, the debate, the debacle, the war, as you said, quoting somebody else, the blue war that happened during that, there were so many predictions that that would actually go to the Democrats' favor, and obviously we're not seeing that.
Yeah, that's right, just the opposite. And again, with people like Heidi Heitkamp, Claire McCaskill losing,
right.
And in Indiana, Joe Donnelly,
right.
Who's considered, you know, calls himself a pro-life Democrat, kind of like my senator in Pennsylvania, Bob Casey Jr., who calls himself a pro-life Democrat, but has a very bad pro-life voting record. And he lost easily. It was Donnelly did. It wasn't even close in Indiana.
Right.
Now, Casey in my state won easily. But it, and even aside from those, though, a couple crucial Senate seats, Jeanette, Ted Cruz squeaked by in his state.
That's right, Texas.
Was it by Bob?
A man, it seemed, was ready to be beaten by somebody.
Right.
That's right. So
is it striking, too, I was going to say, Paul, is it notable, too, that basically the lone Democrat who voted for Brett Kavanaugh is the one who survived in one of the deepest of the red states, and that's Manchin from West Virginia.
Yeah, and it was very close. Very close, Matthew. I think about 49% to 46%. So, I mean, West Virginia now has become extraordinarily Republican, and which would have been inconceivable 30, 40 years ago when it was just totally a union coal miner state that reflexively voted Democrat. But now on cultural issues, sort of God and guns kind of issues, you know, West Virginians overwhelmingly voted against Hillary Clinton and for Donald Trump. And yeah, I don't see how that state doesn't end up turning Republican with Senate seats. And so, but Manchin barely won there, very close. And I would add here, too, Marsha Blackburn in Tennessee,
mm-hmm.
who
right.
you know, Life News describes her as Planned Parenthood arch enemy, Marsha Blackburn, which I think is fair to say. She's a very staunchly pro-life Republican, and she easily won in Tennessee. So whereas the Republicans had some, you know, plenty of bad news in the House, and you know that's where the impeachment stuff is going to happen, I guess Republicans should be very pleased with what happened in the Senate, because almost all of those races, with the exception of maybe Nevada, where Rosen, I think, won Nevada, mm-hmm. almost all of the Republican races went the Republicans' way.
Well, you're somebody who looks very closely at presidential history. And midterms are traditionally not a happy time for incumbents. For sitting presidents. Where does this fall in history? Because the average is you usually lose, about 30 to 35 seats in the House and 4 in the Senate. So would you consider this then to be, we're hearing things like this was a rebuke of President Trump, that this was a crushing defeat for the Republicans. Would you argue that this is actually falling within the sort of historical statistical average for midterms?
Yeah, it absolutely is, Matthew. That is crucial historical context. I mean, it was Democrats shouldn't thump their chests over this, right? Saying, you know, this is all about the Trump resistance. This is vindication of the Trump resistance. Well, this is supposed to happen in the midterm of a president, and Democrats need to look no further than you know, what happened to Barack Obama, right? Two years in. And so yeah, this was very much anticipated, and also too, Democrats in the Senate had far more seats that they had to defend this time than Republicans did in the Senate, and so typically, you know, incumbents in the Senate typically get reelected, but Republicans flipped 4 Democratic seats in the Senate,
right.
You know, again pushing them, you know, comfortably up over 50. So this was. Maybe in the end, if you look at the hard plus minus numbers, this might have been the Democrats might have underperformed a little bit historically. And as much as they like to think that they overperformed, this is probably about average for a midterm in a president's first term.
Are we seeing, in a way, then sort of the failure of celebrities to try to galvanize the vote, because this cycle there seem to be even more celebrities out there stumping against President Trump than we had even in 2016.
Yeah, look at, I think it was Taylor Swift in Tennessee, which was really odd. I didn't expect that. she would be a kind of seeming culture warrior for the ideological left. These things never don't always make a lot of sense, and you know, that didn't work. That didn't go her way. And all the money that was poured into Texas, wow, for Beto O'Rourke. And. And there may be some Democrats thinking, wow, this really shows that Texas is now in play. We got within 3 points of Ted Cruz. I don't know if I would look at it that way. I mean, they ran a kind of a celebrity rock star candidate, and they threw everything that they possibly had at Ted Cruz. They threw a ton of money at him, and they lost. So it probably shows the limit, I think, of some of these sort of celebrity rock star candidates.
Right, and I was looking, I mean, at the New York Times this morning, and they were saying how that sometimes the celebrity pitches and these viral candidates, they just miss their home base. I mean, they miss who is right there and local. So that's always a danger in that style of politics, which is where things seem to be heading. But let's turn we've got 2 minutes left, so we just very much at the end of the show. What can we look forward to, I guess, in the next 2 years as we lead up to 2020?
Well, it's going to be a really rancorous time. I mean, it's just going to, the divisions are just going to get uglier. And I would point to one other case here too, Jeanette. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is now the youngest woman ever elected to Congress, and she's an actual socialist. She's a literal member of the Democratic Socialists of America. And Tom Perez, the DNC chairman, who's a really angry guy and really fired up about the Trump resistance, he says that she now represents the future of the Democratic Party.
Wow.
And she's a literal socialist. I mean, you know, this is the party of JFK, RFK, Harry Truman, FDR. So for someone like that to represent the future of the party, now he's saying that in a positive way. He's trying to be positive there. But unfortunately, I think what we're going to see over the next 2 years is a really nasty knockdown dragout between the Democrats in Congress and Donald Trump in the executive branch.
Sure.
It's not going to be pretty to watch.
Right. So we certainly are a country that is divided. And this is, you're sort of tipping off to one of the stories we're going to do on how younger people voted this election. So Paul Kengor, he's a political science professor at Grove City College. Paul, thanks so much for being with us.
All right. Thanks. Take care.
When we come back, we talk to Joan Frawley-Desmond about the upcoming bishops meeting. Stay tuned to Register Radio on EWTN.
Have you heard who's reading the Register? Why, it's Tim Staples.
The National Catholic Register gives you the world's news like no other. Only NCR has a stable of writers steeped in good Catholic theology and philosophy to give you the news with proper perspective.
For a 3-month free subscription to the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 3 months free banner or call 1-800-421-3230.
Father Wade Menezes talks about the National Catholic Register.
As the National Catholic Register celebrates its 90th anniversary, I think that says a lot about the publication. It presents the teachings of the Church, unabashedly so, and also guides its readers to be even more solidly Catholic themselves.
For a 6-issue free trial of the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 6 free issue banner, or call 800-421-3230 for your 6 free issues.
Missing Catholic radio in your area? Heed God's call to get involved and start a Catholic radio station. Contact Jack Williams, 205-795-5756, or email jwilliams@ewtn.com.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register, and I'm joined by Matthew Bunsen, a Register Senior Editor and my co-host, and we're also joined by Joan Frawley Desmond, another Register Editor, Senior Editor. And both Matthew and Joan will be covering in this coming week the U.S. Bishops' Meeting in Baltimore. Matthew will be there on the ground along with Father Raymond D'Souza, and Joan will be tag-teaming with them to do our reporting on this very important event that happens every year. But, of course, this year, the bishops have just been mired in the clergy sex abuse scandal with a particular spotlight on the bishops themselves and the ways that they have failed to address issues. And so this is all eyes are on the bishops' conference. Joan, welcome to the show again, and thank you for covering this very difficult topic.
Thanks, Jeanette.
So as I said, the bishops are gathering under this cloud of the sexual abuse scandal. How much pressure is on them to accomplish something in this meeting?
I think there's enormous pressure on them. I was just reading a column today by George Weigel, who had been in covering the Synod for Youth in Rome and doing other activities there, and came back and said the anger is unabated. Mm-hmm. I think they're under enormous pressure to show that they understand that some issues have still not been resolved, while at the same time, you know, showing what has happened, because that is important to give hope and some traction and integrity and credibility to their efforts.
Yeah, of course. I mean, George Weigel wrote that. We saw over the weekend, last weekend, the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Boston Globe, you know, writing about bishops of 50, you know, talking about 50 bishops who have mishandled sexual abuse cases since 2002. You know, they're gearing up for the bishops' conference, obviously, with a story like that right before. We saw the Ruth Institute come out with a report talking about the homosexuality in the priesthood and how that has played a factor. But that report by the Ruth Institute also indicated that the, you know, the Dallas Charter may not be working as well as we've all thought it should be. So there has been a lot of attention focused on these coming days of the bishops' meeting. What are some of the steps that they are planning to address in this meeting related to the abuse scandal?
There are three things, and a lot of them are focused on bishop accountability in the wake of the allegations against now Archbishop McCarrick. The fact that people at least had heard rumors, some had even more information than that. And yet, nevertheless, he was advanced through the ranks of the church and ultimately became Archbishop of Washington. So these include a third-party reporting system that would receive confidential phone or online complaints of sexual abuse of minors by a bishop and sexual harassment or sexual misconduct with adults by a bishop. And, of course, this is in reaction to some of the information we've learned from whistleblowers who did try to stop McCarrick, and basically he countermanded their efforts, like a seminary professor, Father Ramsey, who blackballed one of the seminarians who had been involved with McCarrick, only to find that his voting power as a faculty member was rescinded. So ways that they can, whistleblowers and others, victims themselves, can actually report these claims without feeling like they face retaliation, even could, you know, careers and professional work could be undermined.
And Joan, the other things that they're looking at are some of them you almost want to roll your eyes, to be honest. I mean, they're looking at a code of conduct, establishing a code of conduct for the bishops. They're I say we want to roll our eyes because, you know, I mean, isn't there a code of conduct already for the bishops? They are also have talked about a full investigation into Archbishop McCarrick and everything that surrounded that situation. And I guess one of the questions we have as we look at what they are going to establish related to that is, well, how much authority does the conference have? Do the U.S. bishops have in being able to investigate that fully? We do know that the Vatican is looking into to this. It's not a full investigation like an apostolic visitation as we expected. They're looking at the files, I guess, in the archives, and we haven't heard about that over a month, and so we don't know when that will be produced by the Vatican. I guess a key question is, from your perspective, do you think the bishops can restore their credibility? Is this week going to make a stride in trying to do that?
You know, when I look back on how the McCarrick allegations occurred in June, and that immediately sparked demands for, you know, for full investigation and transparency. Here we are now in November. Didn't it seem like November was so far away last June? And now we're in November, and we still don't, we have a lot of interesting developments sort of on the periphery with acknowledgement by Cardinal Ouellette, yes, who leads the Congregation for Bishops in Rome. Yes, there was some knowledge of McCarrick, but, you know, how much? So we've gotten some limited acknowledgement that, yes, something did happen. There were some kinds of, albeit private, restrictions put on McCarrick. But I have spoken with canon lawyers and others about this issue of how this investigation might go forward. It's far from clear how free the bishops will be to investigate themselves. But in the case of McCarrick, they surely can do some sort of investigation of these four dioceses where he was, which includes New York, which is the one that initially reported on the allegation because he was a native New York priest, and that's where they received the allegation. And then Metuchen and Newark, where he had previously served and where we now know there were allegations involving seminary misconduct, and whistleblowers have provided more information. And then finally, Washington, up to now, his successor, Cardinal Wuerl, insisted he didn't know anything, but he did seem to have some understanding that McCarrick at one point was restricted, at another point he wasn't. Issues related to why McCarrick was allowed to be in seminaries, given his history, at least rumors involving misconduct with seminaries. So we have a long list of questions and not as many conclusive answers as a lot of people feel we should by now.
Right, right. Yeah, it really is going to be a very, very interesting week. Matthew, give us a little preview, I guess, of what the schedule of the week will be. And I don't know, sexual abuse is not the only issue on their agenda. So what are the other issues?
Well, yes, exactly. The question, though, becomes one of how the sex abuse crisis is sort of overhanging everything, and that has set the agenda in the sense, especially on that first day on Monday, they'll be doing prayers, they're going to be saying a special mass. So they're, in a way, already anticipating what they're going to be doing in January at Mundelein Seminary, when all the bishops are going to be gathering again to spend a week in prayer and discernment about the sex abuse crisis. That gives you an idea of just how much time they're planning to devote, essentially a full day of spiritual discernment and prayer at this meeting.
Right.
Then they're also going to be hearing, of course, from...
Let me interject there for a second, because that's a direct result, it seems, of the Pope actually asking them to forego this meeting and do a retreat. I mean, that was what he requested a month or two ago. And so yeah, this is a result of the Pope's request for prayer and discernment.
Well, that's right. And it's a kind of a compromise. I think there were a lot of bishops who were happy to have a time of prayer and discernment, but they also recognize that they need to have a time of discussions and concrete action.
Right.
So this is sort of finding a happy medium between the two. But then there are also the other areas that have to go on in the life of any conference, and they're going to have a report, for example, on their upcoming pastoral letter against racism. And then they're also going to hear a report on what just happened, what we were all talking about for weeks and weeks, on the Synod of Bishops on Young People, the Faith and Vocational Discernment. And then more of the mundane business of the conference, including their budget and various conference committee chair people. But the real focus is going to be on the sex abuse crisis, and I think that pastoral letter against racism, because they've been working on that for some time.
Yeah, at least a year. Mm-hmm. And so what is it, a day and a half of open sessions, and then they have their executive sessions? Is that what it's looking like?
That seems to be the case, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, Joan, just to turn back, I mean, we are in the days right before this this meeting. You've been doing some reporting this week, looking at these issues. What have you been working on?
Well, there's some really interesting developments, Jeanette. The Philadelphia Inquirer and Boston Globe stories, for people like us who have been covering this for some time, did not really come up with a lot of new material overall. And as is always the case, some things are presented with a very broad brush, and those of us who know the details of the case feel like, well, this wasn't really explained well.
Right.
There's not much nuance here. But there was one case that was interesting, which I followed up on, and that involves the Diocese of Cheyenne, where now Archbishop Paul Inchen, who has gone on to Anchorage, arrived back in, I think it's 2008, 2009, he was informed by the nuncio. We spoke separately after I saw the report, and he told me that the nuncio had said, by the way, your predecessor is, you know, facing allegations unproven, not even apparently found credible at that time, but still very disturbing, dating back to his time in Kansas City as well as Cheyenne. And so please tell him to keep a low profile. Why is this important? Because one of the issues the bishops want to talk about is initiating a process of developing a code of canon law for bishops regarding canonical affairs and church governance. What do they do with bishops who may face some issues, some restrictions? How is that handled? Well, this case deals with that directly.
Sure.
He arrives and is now faced with his predecessor, who has not had any confirmed allegations, but a troubling history. And so, you know, that kind of case will be interesting to see how it develops.
Absolutely. So we're looking at, again, the accountability for bishops and how they fraternally correct and watch each other. This is Register Radio on EWTN. Check out more news and analysis at ncregister.com. And thanks for joining us here on Register Radio. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Michael Birchfield, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, God bless you.